accession number 19666, Reel 1.
San Jefferson, Reel 2.
This American vessel of John Ericsson, its flag, is in the American Studies Seminar Room at Leicester University, which used to be part of the house of David and Richard Attenborough's father when he was Vice Chancellor of Leicester University. And it was presented to the American Studies Department by an American who was then teaching at Leicester, whose father had been on the last voyage of the John Ericsson in the Pacific. That was the ship that took us out to Cape Town. It has, I think, another significance for British history. It took over to America a large number of English girls, British girls, who'd married GIs and took them to America. I knew one of these girls, a girl called Audrey Swaffield, who's still living in Peterborough, having divorced her American husband. And when their children were on the boat, little babies, they all went down with stomach troubles and had to be intensely treated in Brooklyn Hospital. And the reason for that, I'm quite sure, is that when we got to Freetown in South Africa, in West Africa, we were told to bring on board no unwashed fruit, and of course a lot of it got on board, and we had an epidemic of dysentery on the John Ericsson for 2 or 3 weeks. I had my first attack of dysentery at sea on the John Ericsson on its way to Cape Town. We also had a certain amount of dodging submarines. Then we got to Cape Town, and we had a week in Cape Town, where I was so moved by what was called the colour bar then, that I wrote a poem, which was eventually published in Phylon, the Atlanta University Review of Race and Culture, which is a black American journal, called Crossing the Colour Bar. We then went from...
Well, what specifically did you see of the colour bar there?
Oh, it was terrible. It was probably worse than in the days of apartheid, because in the days of apartheid, blacks were moved right outside the city. And I've been back to South Africa once or twice. I felt the colour bar stuck its ugly face out more before it was called apartheid under Smuts government than paradoxically it did under the Afrikaner nationalist government.
But what specifically did you see?
What did I what?
Specifically did you see?
Oh, I saw you had so many signs all over Cape Town, blacks not here, blacks not there, this seat not here, this seat not there. Lots of people wouldn't agree with that, but that's how it struck me. Then, after a week in Cape Town, we got on the train, went across the Karoo, we stopped in Ladysmith for a bit, and we got to Durban, and we had a few days there, and then we got into a vessel, it was a Dutch ship, and we went over to, we went up to Mombasa in Kenya. We were one of the ships that was sung to by a lady who used to dress in white on Durban Harbour. She had a large, she was an opera singer. She had a large megaphone and she sang Vera Lynn types of songs and things like Will You Know Come Back Again. There's a monument to her, I believe, now in Durban Harbour. Then we got to Mombasa, and that was where my real military career began, because we were posted to African battalions. And I think, looking back now, that it was a wise move of the people who sent us out there to post so many university graduates. Because picking up the African languages, even at a low level, wasn't an easy task. I was, like many people, from Mombasa, I went up on the rail to Nairobi, and we were then posted to the Jeans School, that's the name of a kind of adult education school, which was then running courses for officers and senior NCOs in Swahili. And I started on Swahili and I was doing quite well. Then I'd been on that for about a fortnight, and there was a vacancy for someone in a Nyasa battalion. And I was posted to a place called Mitubiri, not far from Thika. That was one of the Mau Mau centres in the Kenya. To a Nyasa battalion, and I had to learn without any formal instruction, what was called then Chinyanja, but which has since been called by Dr. Banda, because it was his tribal language, Chichewa. And although I say it myself, I didn't do too badly picking up Nyanja. I had a education corporal, Sergeant Peter, to help me, but most of it I picked up myself from a famous old book by two doctors, DCs in Nyasaland as it then was, Sanderson and Bithrie. And then, for the time I was in Mittambeeri, I was learning the language, doing training with a Nyanja-speaking platoon, and guarding Italian prisoners of war, one of whom I later had the amazing experience of taking a trip down the Zambezi in the mid-60s when I went out to do some work in Zambia, and I found that this man had been a prisoner of war and I had been looking after him in early 1943 in Mittambeeri. Then they picked me up and sent me down to Moshi in Tanganyika via Arusha. Most interesting in Arusha, to see the number of Polish refugees. There was a Polish refugee colony there, and some of them were smashing looking young ladies, but I didn't bother about that. I was a very puritanical young man in those days. Then I was under Kilimanjaro for about a couple of months, doing all sorts of training and learning the language more. And then Christmas Day, I think it was 42, another chap who alas has since died, Kenny Mortlock of the Northern Rhodesia Regiment, and I took a trainload of askari from Moshi up to Gilgil in western Kenya. And there at Gilgil, we were training, obviously, for the war in Burma, the most inappropriate country. There wasn't a tree in sight anywhere. And as you know, there's a fair number of trees in Burma. When I was at Gilgil training, I had a very interesting experience of taking a military firing party at a military funeral of a Muslim soldier, a Yao soldier, and they got the Muslim priests, if I may use that inappropriate word, because I don't know the Islamic word, to bury them. It took about 2.5 hours and put them in the grave, let them face Mecca and all the rest of it. I wrote a short account of that, which I also published in this Afro-American magazine after the war. Then, from there, I went over to Mombasa with several brother officers, and there was a Polish ship, took a very large number of askari and European officers and NCOs to Ceylon, to Colombo, for the real jungle training. I don't know how long we were at sea, but while we were at sea, I had a very interesting experience. I was in charge of a troop deck of askari, of teaching Africans how to use a water closet. Now, this is, some people say, oh, they're just savages, they don't know how to use water closets. But if you look at John Masters' novel called The Ravi Lancers, Masters paints a picture in The Ravi Lancers of an Indian cavalry regiment going to the Western Front during the First World War, in which the Indian officers had to be taught how to use a water closet. And this happened. We had a very autocratic Polish officer in charge of our troop deck with me. He called our men filthy beasts, because when they went into the lavatories, they would stand on the seats and let go. Which, of course, that's how they let go in their own outside their own villages. So I had to work out in Nyanja a little battle drill to teach them how to use the water closets. And about half of them learned it, but half of them didn't. And I collected quite a little library of literature on the non-water closet using soldiers of the British Army since then. Then
so you didn't have to. You didn't think it advisable to give a personal demonstration yourself.
I gave a personal demonstration without taking my trousers off. The most difficult one was to work out, pull the chain, and I didn't know what chain was in the anja. So I called it chingui, which is really the word for string. And some pulled the chain and some didn't. Then we got to Ceylon. And there we went up to the jungle, near Dimbula, or Dambula, as people call it, not far away from Kurunegala. And we spent a long time there on jungle training. We were in a holding camp, and as I imagine he's now departed this earth, I can refer to him as the camp was run by a most awful major whose name was Hawes, H-A-W-E-S, who was always known as Fupi Hawes, which is the Yanzi word which we translated idiomatically, short-assed. Fupi Hawes was responsible for an excruciating 30-mile march in full military marching order, which I had to make one night with my platoon, and it happened this way. At a clearing in the jungle, every now and again, we'd have film shows. And the askari would go to these film shows as well. And they didn't know much of the language, but they could appreciate the motion pictures. One week, Fupi Hawes told all the officers and NCOs that African soldiers must not come to the movies this week. They are showing a movie called 40,000 Horsemen. This was the first Australian film, I think, in which Chips Rafferty appeared. And it was about Gallipoli. It was a precursor of the Australian film called Gallipoli. And he said they must not come because there are a number of rather frank sexual scenes in this film. Very wrong for African soldiers to see white people behaving badly sexually. I may say, compared with what you get on television nowadays, they wouldn't have stirred anybody's hair. Anyway, we officers and NCOs took our little wooden chairs and sat there. And there was the screen at the clearing of the jungle, one end. And we looked back and there were thousands of whites of African eyes peering from the jungle at this film. We never said anything. About 10 minutes after it started in the first sexual scene, the lights went up and Fupi Hawes appeared on the stage and said, "Stop! My orders have been disobeyed. There will be a punishment march for all African soldiers in the holding battalion, and one officer per company will go with them." And I was chosen to be the officer in that company. My other memory of Fupi Hawes was when I had to go and bury a white officer in the Corps of Military Police in this holding camp who was shot by an African soldier. I buried him in Kandy.
You mean accidental or deliberate?
Deliberately. Well, it was accidental, in a way I'll explain in a moment. There was a small corps of African police and they had ammunition for their rifles. And one African policeman had a grudge against a white sergeant who brought him up on a charge which he felt was false. And of course the white sergeants and the white officers all messed together. And this African policeman put his rifle through the window of the mess when they were all there. And he aimed at the sergeant that missed him and he got the officer. And I had to bury this officer at Kandy. Fupi Hawes comes into this very unhappy story. As soon as it took place, he said, "There will have to be a slow march procession to the grave before you fire the rounds." And I pointed out that the slow march had gone out of training, pretty obviously, because it takes a fair time to teach people to do a proper slow march. He said, "It doesn't matter, they must learn." And they got 3 days to learn, the six men in the firing party, the slow march, before we went to Kandy. And of course, it was already starting to rain, prelude to the monsoon. They kept slipping all over the football pitch on which they were being trained. So eventually, Foo Pihors decided that there would be no slow march. So I took them down and we marched, not at a light infantry pace, but at a fairly regular, slowish pace to the grave, buried the poor officer, fired the honorary rounds over the top and came back. And on the way back, we got blocked by an elephant whose mahout on his head couldn't move him by a stream. And so we were half an hour late getting back to camp. And anyway, from there...
What happened to the Askari?
Oh, he was eventually court-martialed and shot. I saw another, and experiences of another African shooting a white man, which I'll explain in a moment.
By the way, what unit is this you're with?
That was a holding battalion, all sorts of different people from different battalions and different battalions themselves. And then after 2 or 3 months there, I went to the 13th Nyasaland Battalion, which was already part of the 11th East African Division. And we went from Ceylon, Colombo, helped to pack the stuff on the ship, to Chittagong.
Before you go to Chittagong, how did the Nyasaland Askaris get on with the local Ceylonese?
Not badly. They got on better with the Ceylonese than they did with Indians.
Why?
Well, because they weren't Indians. Because in Nyasaland itself, as in Uganda and all other places, many Indian settlers who ran the local shops and dukas were not always as gentle towards Africans as perhaps they might have been. That's not to say that all Indians were like this. I'm using Indians now to include Pakistanis, the old designation. But they got on quite well with the Ceylonese. There was no problem. Then we got up to Chittagong and stayed a little while there. And then we went up the Brahmaputra, an enormous great vessel that looked rather like Mark Twain's Mississippi River boat. And certain places, there was so much mist and the Brahmaputra was so wide, you couldn't see either bank. And from there, we got up into Assam. And for a short time, we were in Durzari, where I had the rather grim experience of attending an open-air theatre to listen to Noel Coward, who was dreadful. But I did at least have the experience in the midday sun of hearing Noel Coward sing Mad Dogs and Englishmen go out in the midday sun.
In what way was he so dreadful?
He was dreadful because the type of song he chose, with an audience composed largely of Indian sepoys, were things like Senorita Nina from Argentina, and it just didn't really go down very well. Those of us who knew Coward's reputation before we went, of course, appreciated hearing Mad Dogs and Englishmen under the midday sun. But it wasn't really worth the walk across a paddy field carrying a chair to hear him. Then from there, of course, we went up to Manipur, and we took over from some of the little weapon pits which had been left and cleared up a bit after the battle at Kohima. Surprising how many people today have never heard of it, which was surely one of the great battles of the Second World War. And then we got into Lorries and were taken right into Burma. The 13th Nyasaland Battalion with which I served was originally a reconnaissance battalion for the 11th East African Division. All companies were split up into different parts. And this would be north of Tamu, which was a great place in which a terrible concatenation of Japanese dead humans and mules. And we got up there and we did quite a lot of patrolling. Mercifully, there were no Japanese around. And when we started off, our company commander had the brilliant idea of sending us out with a mule. And of course, you can just imagine how quiet a mule keeps at night. Had there been any Japanese around, we should all have been shot within 5 minutes. Then, our battalion, the 13th Nyasaland Battalion, was all over the place doing different sorts of patrols, reconnaissance, fighting patrols. One of the forward companies of the 13th Nyasaland Battalion had the very grim experience of having most of its, or large number of its white officers and many of its NCOs incapacitated through an African action. I wasn't there at the time, but I was flown in a Tiger Moth to relieve this lot. And at that time, there seemed to be no Japanese around, so the officers and the white NCOs were all messing together in a tent with one niali, one lamp. And that night, an African soldier, just as in Ceylon, he felt that he'd been brought up on a wrong charge by a white NCO. And I regret to say that most white NCOs of my experience, particularly those who came from the Rhodesias, were often intolerant towards Africans. And he put his rifle into the... He didn't put a rifle into the tent. I'm getting muddled up. He got a grenade, and he didn't know very much about grenades. He threw this grenade into the tent, thinking it would get just the sergeant who had put him on the charge, which he believed was false. It didn't get the sergeant. It got one of the nicest men in creation, a fellow called Freddie Allen, who was a young white officer from southern Rhodesia and a man of the most liberal views towards Africans. And it knocked out about five or six officers and NCOs. One of them still living today in Liberton in Edinburgh. I met him only 4 or 5 years ago. And I was flown in from the Backwood Company to relieve that lot. And when that battalion lost so many of its men, the platoons in companies, because there weren't enough officers to relieve, were taken over by white NCOs. They're not always like the NCOs that I'd met in Ceylon, or the man who was criticised by the Askari, who was eventually shot, incidentally, after court-martial. And one of the nicest men in creation was Sergeant Harvey, who was one of our NCOs in this forward company, who had been posted in charge of a platoon. And he had the great good fortune of having the only Thompson submachine gun in the company. And we others, who were leading platoons, officers and NCOs, had to make do with Sten guns. The first time I ever fired a Sten gun in action, it jammed, and that's not a unique experience. This was the beginnings of what you might call my frontline experience, and a great deal of it was patrols, long-range patrols. I got, although I say this myself, extremely efficient at taking out, say, a platoon, 30 Africans, or maybe 10 or a handful, going out for 4 or 5 days and getting lost. And then by setting the map with the compass and steering on a bearing between a chong, well-known small river, or a track, always getting back to where we'd set out from. I couldn't do it now. And I marvel, looking back after 55 years, I could get lost so many times in the jungle and get out again, but I could. It was there that I had another unpleasant experience, and I shall not mention any names. But you're looking over there at the Japanese flag. I've had it translated, and it once belonged to a Japanese soldier. Where he is now, I don't know, who'd been in the fire brigade in Tokyo. Our battalion was given the task of sweeping one of the flanks near a place which we used to call Izagyo, but I believe it should be pronounced something like Yezajo. And we'd started off on the top of a hill, and the Japanese immediately skedaddled, as they were skedaddling most of the time. The most of them were starving or dying from beriberi as a result of the retreat from Kohima. And our aircraft came down to shoot up the Japanese, and of course they nearly shot us up. I can remember seeing the bullets drop about less than six feet in front of us. But then they decided to drop leaflets on the Japanese. And when it was all over, I picked up one of these leaflets, which I've still got, And I had it translated by the late Louis Allen, who I'm sure will be very well known to you, and anyone who listens to this who knows anything about Burmese history. And John Nunnally reproduced this leaflet in his short book called Tales from the King's African Rifles. Then after that, not long after it, my platoon, given the task of going further round the right flank and seeing what we could find. We were going round there through thickish to scrub jungle, and all of a sudden there was another platoon led by one of the officers of this company who'd not been hit by the grenade, retreating, scared stiff. I shall not mention his name. He was a very nice man and quite a distinguished player of a popular sport before the war. He said, "Come on, Sam," that was my military nickname, "get out, get out. They're banging away around there." I'm not particularly brave and I might have been obtuse, but I just couldn't hear anything. So he got his lot back, but I got my lot down and I fired my Sten gun. That didn't work. So I threw a grenade approximately in the direction of what we felt, what was in fact a small bunker, which my colleague had said was full of Japanese. Well, if it was full of Japanese, they'd all got out by the time we got there, but they'd left that flag. So I took the flag, which was a very ridiculous thing for me to do, because they might very well have booby-trapped it. They often did this, and I could have blown myself up. But it was a very unfortunate experience. I don't know what happened to that particular officer, but I got put down for a mention for that. And I don't know what the commanding officer, who'd been with the Somalis, very nice man called Humphrey French, said, but he recommended me, as I was told by the adjutant, and it didn't go through. Presumably, if you take over after a retreat, that's not the sort of thing that they want to mention as a mention. But it always disappointed me, because I'd love to have had nothing more than a mention. I subsequently got the CBE for my work for the Commonwealth Institute in Scotland, but I'd rather have had a mention in Burma than the CBE for the Commonwealth Institute in Scotland. After that, things quietened down for a bit, and we did a great deal of patrolling. We took a prisoner. We only took one prisoner. And we were coming down, my platoon was coming down a little track. We got two scouts out in front, and suddenly one of them came back and said, "Bwana, uko, up there." I said, "Jampan." They also call the Japanese Jampans. I said, "What should we do?" I had a look, and there was a young Japanese soldier standing in the middle of the track. Well, I said, "We either shoot the bugger or we go and capture him." And I said, "Let's run." So I shouted out, "Tamangani, run." So we all ran forward. And when this little Japanese soldier saw us, he had no idea we were there, he took out a grenade. And you know, the Japanese grenades, they didn't have pins that pulled out like ours. They had percussion things at the bottom, and they stamped them on the ground or on their belt and then threw them. He was just getting ready to do that, not at us, but to blow himself up. And we got him. And we sent him back, and whatever happened to them after that, I don't know. I only saw two Japanese prisoners of war. He was one. And the other one was when we were in a clearing in the jungle,